to Beyond the Rock podcast. Today, we had the opportunity to interview Mr. Brian Tickle, who happens to be the Texas Regional Director of the Access Fund. And I am absolutely not sorry, but this is quite the Texas-centric podcast episode.
Yeah, we had a great conversation. We got to talk about a lot of things Texas-related, as well as the impact of COVID. And we also talked about access to Inks Ranch, which is a big deal. And we talked a bit about the unique private land situation in Texas.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have about 95% of our land is privately owned. And let's just get right into it. What's up, Brian?
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. What's going on in your world today?
Oh, not too much. Just trying to protect America's climbing.
Which is what you're so great at.
Yeah, trying to protect Texas climbing, trying to crack some of that 95% private property.
And was it a little higher before you got started as the, you're the representative for the Texas?
That's right. Yeah, I'm the state director for Texas and also for Oklahoma and Arkansas.
Okay. So do you mind explaining the Access Fund, what it is and how the representatives are divided among the country?
Sure. The Access Fund is a national organization that advocates for climbers and also conserves the climbing environment. We were founded in 91, and we've grown now to a staff of about 30 people located throughout the U.S. So I'm in Texas. We have people staffed in Washington State, California, Arizona, and then we're headquartered in Boulder, and we've got folks in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and also up in North Conway, New Hampshire. I think I hit everyone. I don't think I left anybody out. So yeah, our work's kind of broken down into a number of different pots, you know, mostly policy and advocacy, stewardship and conservation, and then a lot of land acquisition.
And when you say we started in 1991, who is we?
We is the Access Fund. It was founded by Armando Menical, and it was actually spun off of another organization that you're familiar with, the American Alpine Club.
Yeah,
so that was the origin of the Access Fund. And we were sort of spun off to focus a lot on kind of policy, advocacy work. And of course it was a little bit before my time, so I can't speak to the intricate details, but that was sort of the genesis of the Access Fund.
Right on. So we have a lot to be thankful for as rock climbers, don't we?
We do. Yeah. We're very lucky, in Texas to have the public park system that we do. Otherwise we would just be left with, quite a bit of private property, which is notoriously difficult to access.
Yeah, it definitely is. And out of curiosity, as a landowner, why would somebody not want rock climbers to climb on their property?
Well, I think if you could put yourself in their place for a second and just imagine that somebody knocks on your front door at your house and asks to, you know, do something in your backyard. Most people's natural inclination is to be a little bit suspicious. You know, yeah. Texas is largely a hunting and fishing culture, although that is changing. And a lot of landowners are familiar with how hunting and fishing works. And there's a long tradition of allowing the public onto your property for those activities. But rock climbing is still very much a foreign concept to a lot of landowners. And if they are familiar with it, they're likely to be familiar with it through, you know, what they've seen Alex Honnold doing. You know, everyone's seen the 60-minute segment where he's free soloing. Mm-hmm. And I think they come away with the conception that climbing is a very dangerous activity. So, you know, the conversation always turns to liability. Landowners always have concerns with that. And, you know, then there always is the complication of, well, if we do let somebody onto our property, how do we make money off of it? And that can also be very tricky with climbing. So I think those are kind of the the largest reasons why a landowner would be reluctant to let somebody climb on their property.
Yeah, those are pretty legitimate reasons.
Yeah, and it's funny because a lot of climbers who themselves have bought property that had climbing, sort of their mentality kind of flipped. As soon as they became a landowner, then they were sort of like, I don't really want a lot of climbers coming onto my property to climb, despite sure. being climbers themselves. So, you take on a lot of responsibility as a landowner, and just as you would own a house, in some ways it's no different owning a house than owning, a 30,000 acre ranch. You have the same concerns letting people onto your property to recreate.
Yeah, absolutely. And, speaking of a 30,000 acre ranch, talk to me about some of the most recent wins that the Access Fund has had.
Yeah, well, we haven't had what I would call a huge win on a 30,000 acre ranch. We've been involved in various different ways over the decades. In fact, with the Continental Ranch, which is just under 30,000 acres, and we've also been since my start with the Access Fund in 2017, we've been involved with policy at the Barton Creek Greenbelt. We've had a couple of legislative wins. We've done a lot of work with state parks. And, sort of the most recent big three wins for the Access Fund in Texas have really been Medicine Wall, Monster Rock, and the Inks Ranch.
All right. So we got Medicine Wall in San Antonio. We got Monster Rock in Bee Caves, which is right around the corner from Austin. And then Inks Ranch is in is it considered Fredericksburg?
I think probably Llano.
Llano.
I
mean,
it's between Fredericksburg and Llano.
Yeah, Jeremy was one of the ones who got a ticket.
I remember the name.
And I was really bummed that it got canceled because of COVID. I mean, there's a good reason.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping it gets rescheduled eventually. Get out there and.
Yeah, it will eventually. I'm sure our conversation's going to turn to COVID and how it has just sandbagged all of us. And of course, it was a huge disappointment, both professionally and personally, to have to cancel that event. We had pegged it to be our, signature accomplishment for 2020. And it just, it's a shame that it's, had to be postponed, but we'll get there eventually. And we've got your name on the list, Jeremy.
Good. I'm looking forward to putting up a string of V0s when I'm out there.
Well, there's a ton of bouldering potential, and it's just completely untouched for the most part.
Yeah, I was asking someone else about it because I've heard mixed reviews of whether or not it's been developed or hasn't. Is it all pretty much undeveloped or?
It's almost all undeveloped. What we did was host a couple of route development weekends, and this was back in February. And one of the premises for those weekends was to kind of pair up climbers who were interested in route development but didn't have any experience necessarily, and especially women who didn't have any experience with route development, because that has been for a long time a conversation in the climbing community. So we had a couple of weekends where we matched more experienced route developers with, it was kind of a mentor-mentee relationship. So we had some route development that went on in preparation for the festival. And, we approached it from two angles, really. We thought, well, this is about 1,200 acres of just almost completely untapped granite climbing. And, one thought was, well, let's just have the festival and just, more or less turn people loose into that area and everything they touch will be a first ascent. And what we had kind of decided was that is appealing for a number of climbers. I mean, that would be appealing to me.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of climbers would appreciate having a set number of routes, some established routes that they can get sure. on. So we kind of made the decision, we'll have a limited number of routes established ahead of time, just so we have something for people to climb. But I mean, in terms of the overall development of the area, I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface. The development there could go on for decades, really.
Yeah, lots of opportunity, I remember. Oh, the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So back to this on the subject of COVID.
Enough of dramatic, Emily.
Exactly. Back to COVID is dramatic enough.
Yeah.
How has that impacted access? Has it caused issues anywhere?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the most obvious impact of COVID, of course, is the closure of facilities in public parks, and in many cases, complete closure of parks. And then there's everything that flows from that. I mean, one of the more overlooked consequences of COVID is how it has affected recreation in smaller rural places. In Texas, at least, many rural areas benefit greatly from our state park system. Mm-hmm. Our state parks are massive revenue generators for small communities, and you know, with those parks closed, that has had a real economic impact on those communities, separate and apart from every other kind of economic impact that flows from COVID. So that's you know, one of the most severe consequences. Now, I mean, of course, closures are not going to be a permanent thing, but you know, we're writing the playbook right now for how, you know, COVID and future pandemics will be handled by our public parks managers. Yeah. And so I think a lot of the response that we've seen so far will become permanent in some ways.
Yeah, it does seem like, I mean, it's not that you asked for this, but you're kind of setting the tone, like you just said, for the future, you know, encountering mm-hmm. a situation like this. And it always has to start with the first time. And unfortunately, we're living in the first time.
That's right.
I mean, in our generation, I do know that we have gone through other pandemics.
So. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, something to always remember is, you know, of course, I threw out the statistic earlier about Texas being 95% private property. So that other 5% being public lands, it has a lot of demand placed on it. You know, Texas is a state that is going to double in population by 2050. So you can just kind of imagine the demands that will be placed on our public land system over that time. So, you know, I think a lot of public park systems have wanted to address that, you know, by having reservation systems, because that's a way that they can control how many people come into a park.
Yeah.
But, you know, historically while they've wanted that, I think for a long time, a reservation system, there would be too much political pushback for them to actually enact that kind of access. But now, of course, we've had this pandemic, and, you know, all these parks have now kind of used that to move to a reservation system. And I think it's entirely possible that we'll see those reservation systems stick around for quite a long time, if not permanently.
Since we are about maybe, what, 2-3 months away from climbing season in Texas, do you know, are there any plans to manage things in the fall, winter, spring?
Well, I might argue that you can climb year-round in Texas.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, it's pretty hot outside, though.
Get started early and leave early.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it, mad dogs and Englishmen will go out in this kind of heat. But yeah, to your question about how to manage it in the winter, you know, I think the way that the reservation system is currently set up, some of that will definitely still be around in the winter. Specific to the Barton Creek Greenbelt in Austin, they've sort of launched this pilot program, which I think runs through, don't quote me on this, I think sometime around December. And, you know, the idea of this pilot program is to see how a reservation system works for the Greenbelt. So, you know, I guess the short answer to your question is I don't really know. It's difficult to predict what is going to happen this winter. I mean, I would certainly hope that the incidence of COVID is brought under control and a lot of us can return to at least a somewhat normal life.
Hopefully. I mean, I guess my concern is that because it is, I mean, granted, you can climb all year round in Texas. I'm not saying you can.
We got him on record. We got him on record saying that.
The more popular time to climb is in the wintertime.
That's right.
When is the season in Waco? It's November to like whatever, January. But then you have areas like going out to Enchanted Rock where you're going through all these small mm-hmm. towns and, you know, there's the impact, the possible impact of, you know, people from Austin or the surrounding yeah. areas taking COVID with them.
I mean, that is direction. If the residents, never mind. I'm not even going to go into that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it varies from community to community. Yeah. You know, I've talked to some people in Arkansas who were like, well, you know, we would really rather people did come into our community because, okay. you know, that's our entire economy is built around recreation and, sure. you know, we need those people here. We're suffering. And they're sort of willing to dismiss the risks of COVID and that sort of balance between their, you know, their economic livelihood and their health and wellness. And sure, other areas have been very staunchly, we should not climb, we should stay home. So there's really no, you know, it's just a complete patchwork.
Yeah, you know, until you said it, I didn't consider the fact that these rural towns are so adversely affected. They're adversely affected by COVID in many ways, but you know, you think about where the park systems are and a lot of times they are in these rural towns. And so we, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, hikers and bird watchers and, you know, campers, I didn't realize it, Brian, until you said it, how much, you know, funding that takes away from the park. So I do see both sides of A, don't bring more COVID into our area, but B, you know, we right. need you.
Yeah. And then you have guides who are yes. who make their money yeah. off yep. of that. And
absolutely.
People who rent camping spaces. And just kind of going back to what you were alluding to earlier, Emily, is yes, maybe some people in these small towns aren't wearing masks, but I see a lot of climbers out climbing without masks on. And or, you know, just because, we're outside, you know, but you can't be in that close proximity mm-hmm. to each other and not have masks on, in my yeah, opinion, anyway. I guess there's no real good information out there.
I mean,
we had
Dr. Jamie Roper on, and she, you know, pretty much said they're getting information, you know, or there may be a possible vaccine, and 4 days later, it's not working. And then there's new information. So it is a very confusing time. And that's why, as the founder of the Texas Lady Crushers, I chose to never go onto my platform and tell the women, you know, I think you should do this, or I think you shouldn't do this. I did not feel like it was my place because there's such various amounts of information, many inconsistent. So
yeah, I think we had sort of the same conversation in the Access Fund. And I mean, of course, you can't tell climbers what to do. A key part of the climber's personality is to be fiercely independent. And
sure.
I mean, to even value risk, I would even go as far to say that that's a trait of some climbers. And, you know, I think eventually, I think we can all sort of settle on the fact that wearing a mask, washing your hands, keeping some distance between you and other people is a reasonable and, you know, probably the most effective thing that you can do.
Absolutely.
From my observations of climbers outside, I've seen, you know, almost all of them wearing masks. They seem to have been very socially distanced, but of course I'm not everywhere. But the Leave No Trace organization did some sure. studies about how different user groups responded to the COVID outbreak. And one of the findings, which I thought was very telling from those studies, was that certain groups did a much better job self-regulating and essentially dialing back on their outdoor use than other groups. And climbers, mountain bikers actually did a really good job of, this is when the pandemic really started to flare up. Mm-hmm. They did a really good job of just staying home and, you know, limiting their activity. So that's encouraging.
I think part of that, I wonder if part of that's because climbing is kind of self-regulated. We're used to like checking ourselves. Like,
that's a good point.
You know, if somebody does a first ascent, there's been times when people said they've done first ascents and they obviously didn't, or they didn't climb it or something like that. And eventually the truth comes out. I know at the beginning of the pandemic, people would go out and climb and they'd post videos on Instagram and you'd get shamed for
totally
that.
Totally shamed. So, yeah. Well, and also, but that was, the hospitals were being overrun in a way that they hadn't before. And so because, the cliche climbing, it's not cliche, the truth, climbing is inherently a dangerous activity. We can possibly subject ourselves to hospitalization because of our activities. But then again, you drive a car at 70 miles an hour and you're in a lethal weapon. So
yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, circling back, COVID is always on the brain, but being here in Texas, Brian, in regards, I feel sometimes people do not give Texas enough credit for mm-hmm. what we have available to rock climb. Mm-hmm. Can you just share with us what is different or unique about our landscape and why it is you would want to come travel and spend some time climbing over here?
Yeah, gladly. And I think there is a little, one that's interesting because one of the real challenges in pitching this idea to the Access Fund to staff a full-time person in Texas, that certainly was met with a little skepticism.
Really?
From an organization that, has dealt so much in public lands and is generally operates in areas that have just large swaths of public lands. Uh-huh. And then when you look at the landscape of Texas, even though it's a huge state, so, by acreage, 5% adds up to a lot. We're not exactly blessed with public lands here. That was a bit of a hard sell. And I think that's one thing that makes Texas a little bit unique to the rest of the country. Of course, its size, but, also that there's a lifetime of climbing here. It just happens to all be on private property. Yeah. So that's one of the key, that's the key geographic and political characteristic of Texas. And then the other big component is just the growth in population. So many people are coming here, and long-term, the impact of that on public land system that we do have is going to be very pronounced. So those are kind of like, the focus is how do we access more private lands, mm-hmm. And how do we really protect and make sure that climbers have a voice in how our public lands are managed.
So this is just an Emily question. This is mm-hmm. not prompted. Let's say, for example, you see a huge limestone cliff off of a riverbank. Mm-hmm. As a rock climber, let's say I'm on my kayak and I see this, 40 meter cliff that's just pristine, ready to mm-hmm. be bolted, or maybe just some granite and beautiful crack systems. If I was curious on how to acquire that property, do we go to our Access Fund rep, or would I, if I'm just, the extroverted human I am, do I knock on the door and say, hey, did you ever consider this? Or, like, what's the, for that kind of situation, mm-hmm. what's the process to see if we could potentially access that land?
Well, of course, I would love it if you came to me and cued me into it. It's entirely possible that it's an area that I'm already working on. I have a list of probably 100 different areas that I keep an eye on. But of course, climbers all the time will approach landowners to try to see, whether they'd be interested in allowing climbing. Generally, the best strategy with landowners is just to have kind of a concerted effort, not to have too many chefs in the kitchen, essentially.
Got it.
But yeah, that's one idea. It's probably going to be on private property. And even if it's not, there's a lot of preparing a landowner to allow climbing.
So the best way would be to contact your Access Fund representative and talk to them about this land because you may have already started that process? Is that what I'm...
That's possible. I mean, I think, you know, I would be happy to help in any way that I can. You know, we have a number of climbers in the communities that have, you know, one-on-one relationships with landowners. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if that, there's no sense in gilding the lily. If that works, you know, for them, then
sure.
I don't particularly see the need to step in and try to horn in on what they're doing. But yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to help in any way I can.
All right. So everyone listening, if you have already begun the conversation with somebody, just keep nurturing that relationship. And if it's something new, reach out and see if we can get something started, because the more property we have to access, the more climbing we have.
I might ask, and I'm always shocked that I have to say this. I might ask that people not post videos or pictures on Facebook of some of these areas.
Okay, talk to me about that.
But there just seems to be, you know, more and more I see, you know, pictures that show up on Facebook of areas that are private property, no trespassing, and, you know, there's sort of, you know, videos up of people climbing there or whatever it is. And of course, you know, it's one thing to know about where some of these really access-sensitive areas are, maybe to sort of take a chance and enjoy them yourselves. But it's sort of a different thing to publicize them on Facebook or Instagram. It certainly causes a lot of problems.
I didn't even know. I'm not trying to sound like a goody two-shoes. I don't trespass. And I didn't know that that was a thing.
Oh, for sure. I know guys that boulder in places that you shouldn't be bouldering.
Oh. Yeah, it's a reality in Texas, in fact. I mean, with as much private property as there is, you know, sooner or later you're going to succumb to the allure of that boulder or that cliff that's on the other side of the river.
Okay. Yeah. And okay. I can understand that.
The Access Fund is certainly not the climbing police. I don't want to make it sound like that. I mean, I so do not want to be involved in local politics concerning, you know, people climbing on private property and trespassing. But yeah, there's a concerted effort in Texas to, you know, exploit some of these private properties for public access. And, you know, part of making that happen is, you know, sort of respecting private property and not trespassing, and, you know, certainly not encouraging it by sharing on Facebook or other social media.
Because that could set up, let's say you were trying to work with maybe that landowner, and then they said that, hey, there's already people trespassing. Why do you think that we would want to open this up when people are already disrespecting our property? Is that kind of the reason? Or
sure. I mean,
one of the reasons.
Yeah. I mean, to sort of give a hypothetical, I guess, you know, let's say that we're working with a landowner, you know, somewhere along the Colorado River, mm-hmm. to open up their property for, you know, some kind of climbing access. And they're enthusiastic about it. They've sort of given us the green light to put together a proposal, or to even go forward with, you know, kind of the logistics of whether it's a climbing weekend or some kind of limited access, whatever it is. The landowner is interested and keen to allow climbing. Mm-hmm. And then let's say, you know, a couple of weeks down the road, the landowner catches a bunch of climbers out on their property, you know, bouldering or climbing or whatever. Problem with that is they would then come back to us and say, hey, what happened? We're not ready to open up for climbing. Why did you tell all your friends they could come out here and climb?
Ouch.
Which I could only respond, well, I didn't ask anyone to come out and climb. So it gives the impression that that we don't have a unified front, that we're kind of chaotic, that we kind of just do what we want. So yeah, that's one reason to not trespass. The other would be that you could be charged with criminal trespass.
Sure. Yeah.
And there are a few climbers that have been charged with that.
Well,
we want name names.
But you know what? You reap what you sow. You take the risk.
Yeah.
And you have to
By the way, the Access Fund will not pay for people's legal fees. So I just want to I just wanted to mention that.
You hear that, everybody? If you get yourself in trouble, you get yourself out of it. All right. Sorry, go ahead, Jeremy.
I was going to say, so I have a question. As someone coming, I mean, I've lived in Texas for 12 years now, but I moved here from Michigan. And one of the first things that I always thought was weird was my friends saying, oh, you know, I'm going to go hunting. I have to have a lease. Whereas where I grew up, you just went out in the woods and went hunting. Yeah. Is there a mechanism or some history as to why so much land in Texas is private and not public?
Well, I mean, some of that goes all the way back to the Texas Revolution.
Yeah.
And, you know, without getting too into the weeds about the kind of land culture in Texas, you know, the land in Texas is meant to be used, whether by industry, whether it should be used agriculturally. There's always been this conception that, you know, Texas land is for use. So, you know, when all of these really major grants were being made a very long time ago, the reasoning was really to have land that would be used. So, yeah, I mean, it goes back to the Texas Revolution. In fact, that's how the Inks Ranch, that's been in their family since the Texas Revolution.
Yeah, and wasn't the giving of land part of how people were getting paid in certain eras? Like, that's why it's like so generationally, like these parcels of land that are privately owned go back mm-hmm. so far. Did I hear that wrong or make that up?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there have been land grants for a long time, and the political momentum has always been to have the land being used for something. Now, I mean, of course, it is a value, a Texas value, to have these public lands, and we do have incredible public lands in Texas that are conserved. That's an interesting point to bring up about hunting and fishing, because I think a lot of people have the conception of Texas as being, you know, this is a place where you could come to go hunting. And it's not that way. It's actually very difficult to go hunting in Texas.
Yeah. I come from Michigan, where you just go out and hunt. You just go up to the UP, you go hunt, or you just go out in the mm-hmm. woods and hunt, yeah. or you go down to the lake and go fishing. I mean, but that's, you say that that's kind of the way Texas, you know, that's Texas is a very hunting and fishing state, but Michigan's, I would say, is even more like hunting.
Right.
I think it's part of our state motto somehow. Mm-hmm. I don't remember my junior high Michigan mm-hmm. history classes. Skipping that. Can you talk a little bit about how the Inks Ranch access came about?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think you guys got a little bit of the history from Bill Horton when you talked to him. The Inks Ranch is a granite wonderland not too far away from Enchanted Rock. And, of course, every climber who's ever been to Buzzard's Roost in Enchanted Rock has looked kind of northeast and seen it. And, I mean, I've been looking at it for decades. And it's funny, I actually had dug back through some emails and found emails from, you know, 15 years ago, where I was trying to reach out to the owner of the property.
Oh, wow.
Just through Bill Horton, we were able to essentially get an introduction to the owner, and we put together a little proposal for them that kind of outlined how we thought climbing could be managed, how it would work, kind of a high level view of all these details. And pitched it to the owners, and we didn't hear anything. And I think about a year went by, and during that time, which is very common for a number of ranches and owners that we've worked with, the management of the ranch was kind of changing hands from, you know, the patriarch of the family to the children. And they had very different ideas about how the ranch could be run. So when the children kind of took control of the Inks Ranch, I think, you know, our proposal was back on their radar, and they got really excited about it. So, the real starting piece behind everything was a relationship that Bill Horton had to a cousin of the owners of the ranch. So that's kind of what let us get that introduction. Much easier if you have that than to just cold call a landowner or knock on their door.
Sure.
Maybe you guys don't know yet, but how is access going to be available after, I guess, maybe the launch.
Available after the what?
I was going to say, I was going to say after the festival, but I don't even know if there's going to be another festival. I mean, how is access to Inks Ranch climbing going to be handled?
Yeah, I think it's going to be handled through these open weekends.
Okay.
And, you know, we've sort of started with, you know, that we would do two of these a year, and that we would also be able to do certain smaller events kind of in between, whether it's just trail days or, you know, some different kind of smaller scale events. My hope is that over time we're able to have, you know, more weekends where we can go out there, more weekends where we can open it up to the public. It's never going to be free and open to the public the way Medicine Wall or Monster Rock is. And that's just because they have a number of other operations going on at the ranch. They do a Jeep Jamboree, they do clay shooting, they do hot air ballooning. And of course, it's still their family ranch and vacation spot. So they like to go there as a family and have some quiet time. So for the foreseeable future, you know, we'll try to keep expanding on the number of festivals that we can host and just try to get as many people out there to enjoy the place as we can.
Well, speaking of enjoying places to climb, just out of curiosity, climber to climber, how did you get started climbing, Brian, before we wrap up and ask our last few questions? What drew you to climbing?
I feel like I've given a different answer to this question every time because in some ways it's difficult.
Okay. Well, August 24th, 2020, what is inspiring your answer?
it was something that I could do. It was something that I could do alone. And I had started climbing kind of at the end of high school, but really especially kind of first year of college. And yeah, it was an activity that I could kind of do by myself. It was, to be very candid, it was a form of therapy. I think I had a lot of ideations about mountaineering and the greater ranges. And I used to go up to Washington State with friends and, you know, we did all the volcanoes and things like that. And places like E-Rock were sort of training for that, but you know, at some point the switch just flipped and you know, I realized that I enjoyed rock climbing a lot more than these kind of mountaineering type objectives. So and I was really just a boulderer for the longest time. I probably didn't rope up for like 4 or 5 years once I started climbing.
Jeremy's shaking his head and smiling, probably giving me the ojo because I always give him crap about not getting on a rope, but it's just so all in.
I have sport climbed. I just choose not to. That's all.
Well, that's great, Brian. Well, to wrap up today, why don't you give me a few reasons why we should become Access Fund members and what our community, both in Texas and nationwide, can do to keep the engine running with everything that y'all are doing for us.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind bragging on the Access Fund.
Please brag,
at all. I think I was impressed by them. This was years ago when I just kind of was roped into doing some kind of volunteer legislative work for them and was very impressed by their sophistication. I was very impressed by their approach. And I think I don't mind saying that. I think we're the best at what we do. I think as far as Texas and why everybody should consider becoming a member of the Access Fund, I think we've done some outstanding things in Texas in a very short time. I mean, we've been able to, you know, help Texas Climbers Coalition acquire two properties. We've permanently protected those. I mean, that's an absolute watershed moment for Texas climbing. You know, we were able to, you know, push a bill through the legislature that protects landowners for opening their property to climbing. That's a huge deal. I mean, so many states have those protections. You know, we really were very involved in Proposition 5, which was permanent funding mechanism for state parks, which essentially resolved a 30-year plus issue with state parks is funding. Oh. You know, I think we've done a lot of fantastic things, and we're a member-based organization. So every membership, everybody that comes to a table and signs up to become a member, that has a huge impact. And the second part of your question was about community nationally, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, just in general, as a nation, what can we be doing to contribute, to help out, volunteer opportunity, donations?
Yeah, I mean, we're a nonprofit organization, so of course donations and membership are the key things. And I think, you know, just always leading by example. These are sort of extraordinary times. And I think all of us, not just climbers, anybody going outside to recreate has a little bit more responsibility placed on their shoulders now than, you know, probably in the past. Not just, you know, it has all been hugely complicated by COVID.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, you know, just leading by example. I think joining the Access Fund is a great thing. It allows us to do, you know, national level policy work. It allows us to have, you know, conservation teams that crisscross the country, build trails, rehabilitate climbing areas. It allows us to acquire properties all over the country. It allows us money to grant out to smaller climbing organizations. So yeah, I mean, membership is sort of the kernel of the whole ecosystem.
For sure. Brian, thank you so very much for your time today. Typically, we do shout outs at the end of the episode, but since this episode is really surrounding the Access Fund and why this nonprofit plays such a large role in our community, if you want to shout out anything besides the Access Fund, this is the time. And if you just want to keep it as the Access Fund for your shout out, that's just as well, just as good too.
Well, yeah, thank you for having me on. I really appreciated it. And sure, I could give a shout out to Texas Climbers Coalition for all the fantastic work that they've done. Definitely consider becoming a joint member with Texas Climbers Coalition when you join the Access Fund. The American Alpine Club has done some fantastic work. I think what they're doing at Continental Ranch is really great. You know, we've had so much support from the gyms. You know, really, it's just it's a fantastic community. And of course, in going down the list of shouting out to people, I know I'm going to leave somebody out, but yeah, it's a fantastic community for sure.
It really is. Definitely. My shout out personally, is to be kind to one another. I know it sounds a little lame, but the fact of the matter is, as Brian has mentioned multiple times throughout this podcast episode, this is a very interesting climate that we're living in. And I just feel that considering all that we're going through, just being a little nicer to each other would go a long way. That's just in the general public. That's if you see somebody at the crag, maybe not doing something or doing something that they shouldn't, or potentially needing some guidance, approaching it in a kind way, and just remembering that you were there at one point. And don't forget to vote.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that's really cheesy at all. Oh. I think. You know, we haven't even touched on so many of the other issues that that affect climbing, but yeah, this is really a time where everybody should really try hard to be a little bit extra patient with one another.
Patient, yes.
You know, it's no longer are the issues around climbing just localized to bolting or not bolting or trad climbing versus sport climbing or whatever it is. there's so much bigger now. And of course, we didn't even touch on Black Lives Matter. We didn't touch on one of the other consequences of COVID, which is that it has sort of divided the climbing community in some ways.
It's divided a lot of things. And Brian, honestly, I would love to talk to you for hours. I was just trying to respect your, I know, very extremely valuable time. You're absolutely right. We have a lot that's going on right now that we could discuss. And Yeah.
It is.
Route names getting changed.
Oh, yes. Route name changing.
Yeah.
The need for all of us to just make a little extra effort to be patient with one another, because it would be impossible to fully comprehend what somebody else might be going through completely separate and apart from climbing. Just all the things that are happening. I think it would behoove all of us to be a little patient with one another. And, you know, as far as all the different social movements that are happening and how they impact climbing, I mean, they certainly all do. The route naming issue is huge. Black Lives Matter has some bearing on climbing. Of course, COVID does. And all of these conversations play out in social media, which is inherently a tone-deaf platform. You can't really, it's difficult sometimes to really know somebody's intent or where they're coming from. And yeah, these conversations are messy. Yeah. Now, I think it's important that we all just try to, stay patient with one another. Of course, nobody is going to get things 100% right when they engage on some of these issues. So.
Sure. Very well said, Brian. Absolutely. Jeremy, what you got for us?
I was just going to say, be kind to yourself.
Oh, yeah.
This is a hard time for everybody. And I know a lot of people are climbing again. Some people still haven't got back into climbing yet because they haven't had the opportunity. And it's going to be hard to get back into climbing if you haven't climbed in 4 or 5 months, however long it's been. I've lost track. Time means nothing anymore. So just be kind to yourself. Or even if you are climbing and you're stuck at home more frequently than you used to, just be patient with yourself. And another issue is, and I know it's because it's happening to me, my friends are out climbing, but I do not feel comfortable going out and climbing with them yet. And so I feel a little FOMO, like, oh, I'm not out there with them.
Yeah.
But I also know that I'm not willing to take that risk yet. And just be kind with yourself about that. And just know that that's what you have to do for you to feel comfortable, and other people are going to feel comfortable doing other things.
And as friends of people like that, if you are climbing, support your friends who are choosing not to. Don't rag on them. That's not cool. That's not nice.
Yeah, for sure.
So.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Right on. Well, gentlemen, it has been a pleasure.
Yes. Brian, I really appreciate all you do with the Access Fund, and I appreciate you sitting down and talking with us today. It's great.
Thank you guys so much for having me on.
For sure. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Bye.